thank you very much for that kind introduction, and it's just an honor to be here and speaking to all of you. It's really exciting to be... I'm going to start with a little bit of a backdrop of Detroit and then move into the really exciting things that are going on here. I love my state so much that Dr. Fulner kindly has allowed me the past 2 years. I started working remotely from Detroit. So I still work with Heritage, but work in right outside my home state. So growing up on 8 Mile in a Detroit suburb, Detroit and Michigan have always been home and have held a special place in my heart. As I matured, though, I began to get a better sense of the challenges, the deep social and economic decay that grew in the city. I had grown frustrated with the disparagement of the city that I would always hear, always the negative example of the welfare state, right? And saw how many of my friends, including me, moved out to work in another state and weren't staying to build back our city, our home. Now, however, you've really started to see the opposite these past few years. Bright young people from California to New York are moving to Detroit to be part of the cultural economic renaissance that's going on in our city. Just this summer, Detroit investor and entrepreneur Dan Gilbert received over 8,700 applications for his internship program. Think about that. And this is just the beginning. Many are eyeing Detroit's inexpensive cost of living and looking at the potential to start new firms, new nonprofits, and really make a difference in our community. Whoever thought there'd be a tech town in Detroit? None of this renewed optimism has been a government-engineered, centrally managed renewal. If anything, decreasing the state and federal initiative in Detroit has allowed for the reemergence of civil society and what some have called the post-apocalyptic city. The best we can do now is to give these small, intermediate associations room to flourish in hopes that not only the downtown, but the depressed parts in Detroit's neighborhoods will reemerge in organic renewal. Broadly considered, the factors contributing to Detroit's decline can be categorized as economic or cultural. With our discussions this weekend, I'm obviously going to focus on the cultural and the exciting things that have gone on this front. In just a half century, Detroit's ethnic composition had flipped, 80% white in 1950 to 83% black today. The backdrop for the initial stages of this demographic was, you know, two major race riots in 1943 and 1946, respectively. And though the racial tension is a deep, troubling aspect of Detroit's history, it's missing the mark to pinpoint this. Detroit's population has plummeted 63% since 1950 and 26% since 2000 alone. Many of this mass exodus saw the high-income earners leaving Detroit over these years. And this is where the dynamics mix. As Detroit grew worse and worse economically, it became less and less attractive for the people who had money. So they moved out, and we've heard this term white flight over the years. But Detroit also saw the upper and middle class blacks move out of the city. And the result was that typical poverty trap. Wealthy residents leave and poor residents remain, in turn prompting more middle and upper class flight and depleting the tax base of the city. Now, of course, there are other cultural factors. One particularly perceptive Detroit native and historian remarked in 1982 that, quote, "Nobody can take pleasure in knowing Detroit well nowadays, even in these United States. There takes form future collectivism, like one of H.G. Wells' utopias or Huxley's dystopia." Writing for Modern Age, Russell Kirk wrote this analysis of Detroit as a response to the bleak architecture he witnessed all around him. His theory was that bad architecture led to bad social attitudes, and bad social attitudes might lead to riots. And he might not be too far off base. In his final address as governor of Michigan, George Romney attributed the Great Detroit Riots to the provocation of, quote, urban renewal and federal highway building. While it's certainly possible that Kirk's evaluation of Detroit has much to do with his affectionate admiration of Gothic spires, his was still a valuable insight on urban planning and cultural attitudes. This same year, James Q. Wilson wrote on a similar topic for The Atlantic, on broken windows and neighborhood crime. Wilson argued that, quote, "At the community level, disorder and crime are usually inextricably linked in a kind of developmental sequence. If a window is broken and is left unrepaired, all the rest of the windows will soon be broken." Flash forward to Detroit some 32 years later, where 40% of the city's streetlights are out of commission, and there are approximately 14 arsons a day. You will get a clear picture of this urban disorder Wilson was describing. Unfortunately, our crime rates have remained some of the highest in the country. It's common to see these photo essays of Detroit's architectural decline. Broken windows indeed. But where is the welfare state in all of this? I'm not going to go into the details. I know we've covered all this morning, but Detroit is said to have the highest child poverty in the country, and I know Clark's really going to get into this and talking about the importance of charter schools and other things we can do to help these kids. In The Tragedy of the American Compassion, Marvin Olasky informs us that, quote, in Detroit, the war on poverty meant that some auto workers could earn more by joining job training programs rather than working. Economist Thomas Sowell also notes that while the 1960s welfare programs were meant to decrease the riots, the rate of riots increased. This same correlation between increased state initiative and decreased social cohesion was true for educational outcomes, marriage rates, and criminal activity. While it is unclear to what extent the present welfare state may have exacerbated these or even initiated the unhealthy trends in Detroit by incentivizing the family dissolution and dependence on government handouts, it's at least clear that the welfare state has done nothing to reduce poverty at its root level. And how could it? Throwing money at the problem does not help because it's not a monetary problem. You've already heard that majority of the families with children only have a single mother at the top. How can greater monetary assistance replace that basic need for a mother and a father? Take my sister's fifth grade class last year from a charter school in Detroit. Out of her 28 fifth graders, how many do you think had a married mother and father at home? Two. Two out of her 28 kids had a married mom and dad at home. Think about that. These young boys and girls do not know what a family looks like. You can see it as they get older and stay in this cycle of poverty and violence. No state program can take the place of a mom and a dad in the formation of a young child. You can read the statistics and we can talk about all of this, but it does not come close to the reality of what that young child is experiencing. I am deeply convinced, wrote Tocqueville, that any permanent, regular administrative system whose aim will be to provide for the needs of the poor will breed more miseries than it can cure. As is typical for Tocqueville, he seems to understand the situation a good century prior to its natural conclusion. But if it is true that God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong, then perhaps we ought to return to the diverse pluralism of intermediate association, the source of lasting results. It is these little platoons that are needed to rebuild the decaying foundations. And so I return to my optimism. Many in Detroit are doing just that today. The sheer failure of the welfare system in Detroit has allowed for small groups of citizens to make their way again. Of course, Clark and Stewart are going to get into what they're doing both in Detroit and Stewart in Grand Rapids. So I will give you a broad survey of some of the exciting little platoons happening now in Detroit. And I don't know everything about all of these, and I don't even know all the current little platoons currently in Detroit, but isn't that a good thing? Detroit is experiencing the private charities, businesses, community groups that are starting to lead to real results for these families, for these children. However, unlike that anonymous action of the state, the great thing about this emerging civil society is that they are agents of renewal. A good example of voluntary association that stepped in to fill the empty space left by the government is the Detroit Threat Management Center. They're a private security force that empowers locals to protect their communities in the absence of the police force. I mentioned how high the crime is. These community citizens took it upon themselves to protect their own interests, their neighborhoods. This unplanned devolution of police powers has been very advantageous for the community. It began in 1994 when one man wanted to make a difference. He wanted to provide greater protection for family and businesses in his neighborhood. And now his 7th precinct has had a 90% reduction in crime. The monthly homicides and daily home invasions have nearly halted thanks to the deterrents. And today they are still training, educating, and protecting their residents. Now the growth of civil society is not merely a fight against disorder. It's also a fight for the cultivation of order. Take, for instance, the nonprofit Neighborhoods Building Brightmore. This is an incredible safe refuge for youth in Detroit. It's fighting against the drug trafficking, the violence, the prostitution. That has really started as a cascade of urban renewal. As they describe it, they are through the help of an ever-increasing amount of volunteers and neighbors, they're cleaning up the neighborhoods, getting rid of the broken windows, making a difference. Families are getting involved, and new gardens, families, farms are expanding, and they're regaining hope in these neighborhoods. Free enterprise is also making a comeback in Detroit. And I'm not just talking about the large corporate kind, as beneficial as it may be to downtown. Rebel Nell, a jewelry store started by an attorney downtown, recycles graffiti and street materials, turning them into rings and earrings. It draws labor from a local women's shelter. Many of these women have had no prior experience running a business, let alone working in one. Fewer still lack the habits and knowledge necessary to process a check or keep a budget. Yet, rather than serving a top-down directive, Rebel Nell involves all of its women on the managerial side of the business, teaching them the virtues of responsibility, thrift, self-discipline, and order. Their mission is to employ disadvantaged women in Detroit, educate them on business and life skills, and empower them to transition to an independent life. This spirit of entrepreneurial creativity is not just limited to small organizations. It's also flourishing downtown. One of my favorite examples is the Grand Circus, which is a very cool tech training that doubles as a co-working space and an event venue. The startups come together and are putting investment into our city, and it's continuing to grow. And while these bigger private initiatives are effective means of change, many are focused in the downtown area. But what about the areas of Detroit that are really suffering? The real test for Detroit is to change for the majority of people who live there. When will those roughly 675,000 people who live in the far-flung neighborhoods, isolated and beset by poverty, feel the effects of the momentum that's sweeping downtown and midtown? It is hard to process that you can eat at one of the best restaurants in Detroit, step outside, and be next to a burnt down building. We need to expand and keep growing this momentum generated by the great little platoons and civil society that is growing in Detroit. We need to give our time, money, intellectual resources to defending this small scale change, not just in Detroit, not just in Michigan, but in all of our cities across the country. We need to be involved in the civil society, helping out in our ways. And we need to take advantage of the administrative state's failure and talk about it. We need to show how it failed real people, all people. We need to talk about what individuals in Detroit and kids need as a mom and a dad, churches, civil society, education, private charities, all coming together. We need to not be afraid to talk about the vitality of families, about the importance of churches, synagogues, mosques in forming a community's culture. About the little platoons I've mentioned, solving problems and bringing communities together. We must reshape the conversation for civil society and get involved in our civil societies. And if the welfare state returns and tries to claim credit for the successes of our civil society, our response must be singular and clear. Back off. This is our town. Thank you.